Hey y'all, here we are again with one of our matinee shows. This one was actually sort of indirectly, I guess, sent to us by a UK fan, Dermot.
Yeah, he sent us the money to buy
it. Who sent me the Amazon gift card to buy it with.
Yeah.
And I really can't believe that we haven't done this fucking movie because this is only one of the best movies ever made. Come on now.
Yeah, I got the 45th anniversary Blu-ray 4K edition with the entire little booklet and all that shit.
Has that
the
cool 3D ass cover. DVD cover. Oh, it's so
yeah.
cool. And it's also kind of scary because sharks are fucking terrifying.
Yeah. This movie was probably the original blockbuster.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because
started the whole phenomenon.
Yeah, not only I, you know what, prior to this coming out in the summer of 1975, I think that summer was not seen as blockbuster season at all, which is funny because everybody just thinks of it like, oh, that's when the big tentpole movies come out in the summertime, not before Jaws came out. They came out in the wintertime prior to that.
I remember it when it came out as a kid. I was living in Long Beach, California at the time. And when Jaws came out, I was 6 years old. Everybody was talking about it. The fucking theme song, the doo-doo, doo-doo, and all that. And everybody older than me was talking about it. I wasn't able to see it. They didn't take me to see it, but my parents saw it. I saw it later, okay?
Yeah.
But I remember when it came out and what a phenomenon it was. And that was the beginning of the Hollywood that we know if you're alive. It was that time.
Oh, yeah.
Everything went, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, and these guys started off as almost like indie filmmakers. Big studios didn't make films like this. They'd just come out of making things like Westerns and cop-type movies and Private Eye-type movies, you know, like Bullet and all that. They were okay for the time, but this was the new Hollywood that I grew up with later on. It was announced with Jaws. That changed the game. Those days are over. But I was happy to grow up during this era because we got some of the best movies from new dudes, you know, Terminator 1, Predator, all that kind of stuff. And it came from this movie.
Yeah.
This is the movie that changed the game that allowed all those other franchises to appear.
And it's really crazy because considering the backstory of how Jaws got made, one, it's amazing that it came out being one of the best movies ever because the whole production was went way over budget, way over time. It was just plagued with problems like the whole entire time they were making it, which usually spells disaster. But for some reason, this one was just fucking magic.
Yeah.
And another thing I was going to say, too, was that Steven Spielberg had made a couple movies before this. I believe the one he made before this was Sugarland Express, but he wasn't a big name.
No.
You know what I mean? Not at all. And he wasn't even the first choice to direct this.
Yeah. When Lucas came out with Star Wars, he wasn't a big name either.
Yeah.
These were brand new guys. They had an indie film background. They were making movies that the old studios of that era would have betted against. They'd be like, a movie about a shark? That'll never make money.
Although, interestingly, the book, you know, the Peter Benchley book, I think that the rights to it were optioned by a dude at Disney without corporate approval. Because he loved the book actually hadn't been published yet, but he got like a galley of it. And he's like, oh my God, that would make a great fucking movie. So he went ahead and paid for the rights. And then he got fired. But then he took the rights like somewhere else. And they're the ones that ended up making it.
Well, new guys knew that the ways of the old studios were coming to an end. You just couldn't live off of making damn Westerns and cop movies. You had to fucking make interesting new movies for a new generation.
Yeah.
And this is the first one, really.
And the thing is, like, a lot of people were making interesting movies in the 60s and 70s. I feel like, too, in the 60s and 70s, you got more of, like, the auteur type of movies, where it was just, like, one director's vision, and a lot of them were kind of, you know, subversive or whatever. So you had a lot of that. This one was kind of your first big, I guess, like, a crowd-pleasing movie that everybody could see, but there was also a really, really quality flick.
Yeah. They were aimed at the mainstream.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? But they were one man's vision. They weren't compromising, but it was still a movie for everybody.
Yeah.
The style back then is the winning style, if you ask me. If you compare it to today, they would try to do something like, well, the way they interpret the situation is very different. They would say, we have this story and we got to make this movie for everybody. So let's go and kind of change and make the entire cast totally diverse and it'll be for everybody. That's not how you do it. You tell the story from a point of view of a couple people, and then the story itself becomes for everybody. The cast doesn't have to be that diverse. The story has to be relatable to everybody. Here's an example. When I want to see a samurai movie, I want to see Japanese people in it. I want that samurai movie to come from Japan. I don't even want it to be in English. All right, there's no diversity there in that. But that story is for everybody. You know what I mean?
Well, it's stuff that everybody can relate to.
Everybody can relate to, but I'm being told this story through the eyes of Japanese people. That's why I'm watching it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think Hollywood's lost its way. They don't really understand that anymore in the modern era. But they understood it back in the 70s and the 80s and in the and parts of the 90s. Just tell a damn story. If it's a good story, everybody will like it.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't think I've ever met a single motherfucker on this earth that does not like Jaws.
Yeah.
How could you not like Jaws?
Yeah.
It's a great fucking movie.
Yeah, it was.
It's everything. It's scary. It's funny. It's got like great characters. It's got great special effects. It's just, it's a fantastic fan. Everything about it is good.
Yeah, and everything about it makes sense. It's New Englanders coming from different classes. One of them is a law enforcement. The other one is a fucking salty ass fucking sea veteran. And the other one is a younger up and coming scientist. And they're all trying to catch this big damn shark.
Yeah. And I mean, you can't really get any better than that.
Right.
It's like a monster movie, but it's like an elevated monster movie.
Yeah. And they're up in New England, and they're the kind of guys that you would meet in New England, you know, doing this. So it all just kind of made sense.
Yeah.
It feels very authentic.
I mean, I kind of want to say, too, that I didn't even realize this until I was watching a couple of, film students or film historians like breaking down Jaws. And they said, you know, not only was Jaws kind of the start of the summer blockbuster phenomenon, I should note, too, that it was also the start of the wide release for a big tentpole movie. Because prior to that, they didn't really do that. Everything was kind of a slow release. Like, they would release things in big cities, and then if it did well, they would kind of expand it. Whereas this one, they wanted to open it everywhere, like, at the same time, which was kind of unprecedented at that time. So this one was the first one to do a lot of things that people take for granted nowadays. But something that I didn't realize was that, you know how, you know, your standard popular, mainstream movies have your three-act structure, which that's not even, I mean, books have that, everything has that, because it works, you know what I mean? That formula, it works. But this movie, I mean, normally a movie would be, like, the formulaic three-act structure is usually like first act is 25% of the movie, second act is 50% of the movie, and then the climax and whatever and the denouement or whatever, that's another 25%. What Jaws does is they do the first act takes half of the movie, where they're establishing the characters. Yes, there are some shark attacks, but they don't show the shark until about an hour in, which I think was a genius move, even though it wasn't completely done on purpose. But then it's like, then the second act is 25% and then the third act is 25% and the whole thing with the scene where Quint is talking about the USS Indianapolis and all the people getting eaten by sharks. That's almost kind of like that's almost toward the end of the movie. Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's a masterpiece move to put that character as a survivor of the Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Cause if you guys don't know what that was, the Indianapolis was on a secret mission to deliver the atomic bomb out to an atoll that we had taken. And they were going to load that onto the Enola Gay and bomb Japan with it. Well, they delivered the bomb, but later got sunk. They got torpedoed, and like 1,100 dudes went in the water. And because they were on a secret mission, the U.S. Navy pretended like they didn't know about it because they didn't want anybody to know that ship was out there. So they let all those dudes just sit in the water and be eaten for about a week. I think it was 5 days.
Yeah.
They were found all floating out in the water by accident by a seaplane, who did give aid to them. But they were just going to be sacrificed. Well, it started 1,100 dudes, and 5 days later, only 300 left. They had all been eaten by sharks.
Yep.
All right.
Absolutely true story. Yeah,
so this guy who's this salty motherfucker who acts like a real dick, you're like, man, what is this dude? What is it about this dude that he makes him so high and mighty? Well, he did have a grudge against the sharks, and he was hardcore. He was a hardcore survivor back when he was young of the Indianapolis. So that was kind of his street cred. You don't find out towards the end, like, And you know, and even the Richard Dreyfuss character who was jealous of him, animosity, was like, oh damn, you survived that. And that was his jacket. That was his fucking street cred. You know, he was a survivor of that. So that kind of gave him his credibility. But he was also a Captain Ahab. He went down fighting that shark.
Yeah. And plus he made some really stupid, rash decisions and stupid mistakes.
Yeah.
Well, the best thing about this, and I was actually thinking this when we were rewatching the movie again, and I was glad to see that a couple other reviewers pointed this out as well. One of the best things about this movie is the three characters, you know, of Quint and Brody and Hooper, who are very much like the trio at the middle of like Star Trek, where each of them has something to bring to the table, but they're all vastly very different.
Yeah.
And so throughout the whole movie, you're getting this kind of conflict, particularly between Hooper, who is younger. He comes from money and he's like more scientist based. Even though he knows his shit, like he's been out in ships, he knows everything about sharks and everything like that.
He can dive.
Yeah, he's a diver and stuff. Yeah. So he's not like some soft like mama's boy or whatever.
He has hard high tech weaponry.
Yeah, but he's kind of like represents the new thing, like with all this new technology. Whereas Quint is much more like the old fashioned. I mean, they establish early on that he's really good at what he does too, because his like shack is all full of like, you know, shark teeth and like shark that he's caught. Everybody in town knows who he is. He has a reputation, but he kind of feels like, well, you know, all this new stuff, it's almost kind of like cheating or whatever.
Yeah.
So him and Hooper like butt heads a lot because they kind of feel like both of them feel like the other one doesn't know what they're doing.
Well, there's class. There's also social class happening here.
Yeah.
Quint is working man, self-made. He came up through a system of military service and then maritime apprenticeship and actually doing things in the real world the old school way on these ships. You know what I mean? He was a commercial seaman. You don't really go to schools per se for that. You don't go to universities for that. You go to basically little trade schools and training programs and you serve under the command of fucking captains. All right. So it's hard-earned. Learn as you go, taught through mentorship and apprenticeship. And you got the other guy who did it through a university system and the more highbrow version of it. So you got kind of like intellectual class versus working class. They got on the same mission. They both had their own strengths and weaknesses, which, you know, it kind of played out. And then Brody's law enforcement. He's kind of like the reasonable guy in the middle.
And he's kind of like the common sense dude, but he's also like the guy that doesn't have any experience with this kind of stuff.
Right, yeah. He's kind of the stand-in for the everyman.
Yeah. Like, he's not a boat guy. He doesn't like the water.
Yeah.
You know, he just wants to go because he wants to keep his family safe. Right. And so he, you know, even though he's terrified, even though he doesn't really know anything about what they're doing, he volunteers. He's like, you know, I'm going to go with you because I want to help kill this shark.
Look, the movie's about a damn shark. Catching a damn shark. There's not a whole lot there. The movie is fucking character driven, suspense driven. It's these three dudes trying to catch this monster. It's great. It's a masterpiece.
I mean, it really is. It's honestly one of the best movies ever made.
If you didn't have great acting and great characters, the movie would have been forgotten. You see this movie to see these characters. That's what it's
Well, like I said, it's almost like the guy, like, you know, Spock, Kirk, and Bones on Star Trek. It's the same kind of dynamic.
Yeah.
And I love the scene where they're all getting drunk together in the cabin, you know, like where, like prior to him giving the USS Indianapolis speech, which is one of the most famous
monologues. Comparing battle wounds.
Comparing scars and stuff. But that was the first time that they all came together as a team. Like, prior to that, they'd kind of been butting heads. Like I said, Hooper and Quint are kind of like, you know, new guy versus old guy.
It was a pissing contest.
And Brody was kind of like, because he just didn't know anything about anything. And so they just thought he was kind of a nuisance because it's like, what are you even doing here? But, I mean, you know, not like that. But it was kind of, he didn't know anything about ships. He didn't know
He's
anything.
Standing for the audience.
Yeah. So, but that was kind of the first time that they all kind of came together and were all on the same team. And so they all had like such a great arc. I mean, particularly Brody, who started out, you know, because they established this like pretty elegantly in the movie that him and his family have moved to this town, to Amity from New York City. And so he doesn't really know anything about the water. He doesn't know anything about this community. The community kind of looks at him a little bit askance because he's not from there. He's like an outsider. And they don't really, I like that they don't hammer that home, but It's just little subtle things. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. No one's hostile toward him outright, but you can tell that they think that he's not one of them.
Yeah.
You know, the same thing, because there's even a couple things saying, you know, if you didn't grow up here, then you're never going to be accepted because you're still just like an outsider.
Yeah.
And I just really like the way they, you know, put all these characters together. And I should say, too, like I said, the novel by Peter Benchley, which, you know, that they read before it was even published and were like, yeah, we're going to make this into a movie. I read the book, and it's funny because somebody else in the YouTube comments mentioned this as well, that they saw the movie first and then they read the book, and they're like, you know, the movie is like so much better than the book, which is, I mean, the book is good, but this is another example where I think the movie is much better, because I will say that in the book, there's a subplot that Brody's wife and Hooper have an affair. Which I think that was probably not good. Like, that was better to leave that out because, you know, yes, it would have caused more conflict between the two guys or whatever. But I don't think that's really needed because there was enough conflict. There was enough, like, you know, different personalities. And I kind of liked that Hooper and Brody weren't really at loggerheads.
No, they had
the same, they were friends. They had the same, their personalities were very different, but they had the same mission. So I liked that those two were kind of like backing each other up. And then Quint was kind of like the, you know, the one that was causing rancor, like within the trio.
Brody being, I guess, chief of police of the damn island. He was in a neutral position. How are we going to solve this problem with this shark eating everybody?
You know? Yeah.
The mayor doesn't want the place. Wasn't he the mayor that didn't want to shut it down?
Yeah.
And his kids were out there too, you know, out in the water. And then fucking.
But three people had to get eaten before the mayor would finally be like, oh, yeah, maybe we should close the beach.
So Brody's kind of like in this middle position where he's trying to make the best decision. Eventually he's like, let's hire that dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, Quint guy. What's
Quint.
His name? Quint. Yeah. Let's hire Quint to go get that shark. And but he also had aligned with Hooper too about cutting the other shark open and doing it, you know, and accepting the fact that the shark that they caught is not the Jaws shark, that's a much smaller shark, you know, the bite radius wasn't right. You know, Hooper didn't really want to accept that. He wanted it to be that shark, but then he started like, yeah, it probably isn't that shark. You know,
well, so Hooper,
that's really where their friendship kind of is
were backing one another up.
Yeah. Where he figured, yeah, Hooper's probably right. That's not the same shark.
He was pretty convinced that it wasn't the same shark. I mean, he wanted to go cut it open just to make sure, but he was pretty sure when he measured the mouth. But the thing about it, and like I said, that's where a lot of the conflict comes from too, because Brody, like I said, being the chief of police, but also being not from there, and so a little bit of an outsider, is kind of coming at it from, you know, the mayor and all the other city officials. All they really care about is, oh, it's 4th of July weekend. This is our, you know, town's kind of claim to fame. Everybody's going to come here and spend money. We need the tourist dollars. So we just can't close the beaches off, and all these business owners and shit are going to lose money. So that was pretty much their only concern. So when, you know, Chrissy, who was the first victim, you know, you see her at the very beginning, like skinny dipping, and she gets pulled under and eaten. And then they find her the next day. And then that little kid gets eaten. And then there's like that other boat with that great jump scare where that head like pops out of the bottom of the fishing boat, which is probably one of the best jump scares ever. But it's like, once it gets to that point, and once it gets to the point where the shark actually comes in and attacks, when all these people are at the beach and the mayor realizes, hey, my kids were at the beach too, and that could have been my kid. Then finally, after three or four people I got chewed up, he finally decides, okay, we're going to do it. Let's hire Quint. Let's do something about it. But it takes that long for him to, because like I said, all they cared about was the profit motive. And the fact too, that they were so quick, the mayor was so quick to be like, that one shark that got caught, to be like, oh yeah, that's got to be it. Let's, you know, just forget all about it. And so we can open the beaches up. She, you know, sharks caught, nothing to see here. You know, by offering the $3,000, which, because it was $3,000 at first, and then all those people, idiots, like came from out of town because they heard about this $3,000. So then they caused even more chaos and even more people being in the water, because all these people were trying to like go out there and catch the shark and get the $3,000, and none of them knew what they were doing. So probably they should have just hired Quint to start with, but you know.
What stands out to me about the movie is the fantastic acting. There isn't any bad acting in the movie. Roy, he knocks it out of the park playing the cop. The dude that played Quint,
Robert Shaw.
Robert Shaw just steals the show. All right.
He's but so good at this.
He just steals the damn show with that character. I don't know if he did any other movies. This is the only time I've seen that guy, you know.
Yeah, he was in some other movies.
I'll tell you what, man, that character and hit in the way he did that character just fucking takes the cake. And Dreyfus is fucking great in this movie. I mean, up there with Close Encounters, you know.
Yeah, it's like it's a really different character, but yeah. I really, really like.
I always liked Dreyfus.
Yeah, I did too.
He's kind of like the smart little guy.
Yeah,
that's what you know, and the everyman. He does those kind of roles, but he just fucking this is movie's a masterpiece. It aged really, really well. The shark even looks really good. Now, when it eats Quint, you can tell it's not a real shark, but it didn't take me out of the movie. It didn't take me out of the movie. But yeah. When it was in the water, I was like, was that a real shark? It wasn't. It was something towed by another boat. When it goes by that, it looked like a real damn shark, like a huge, huge shark. But it was just some kind of model that they were towing with another boat.
I think they had three different models of the shark, which they called Bruce, which most people know. They had one that was kind of like full, that was like one side that went back and forth. And then they had another one that was kind of like from the other side that went back and forth. And then they had one that they could pull like from underwater.
Yeah. The one that you could see from the top. And that shot.
Like pulled on a tow line.
I could tell, but it looked real. But I was saying the only way they could have done that is it was like a submersible that they were towing.
Yeah.
That's but it what looked it was. Like a real shark. Although I couldn't see the back one third of the damn shark. Did it have a tail?
It might not have.
Just the front and the middle.
It might not have. Because I think some of them weren't entire sharks.
Yeah, it didn't look like an entire shark, but it convinced me that there was a shark. Maybe you thought that maybe just the back of it was in shadow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I was like, it was definitely a real object.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely looked a hell of a lot better than CGI.
If you told me it was a real shark, I would go, oh, okay.
Now, the shots that were done underwater, those were real sharks.
Yeah.
And those were actually filmed by a husband and wife diving team. I can't remember what their names are, but they filmed those off of Australia. Now, the scene where the shark attacks the cage.
Yeah, that looked real.
It was. What ended up and that was totally accidental.
Was it?
What ended up happening in the book, and I think in the original screenplay of the movie, Hooper actually does get eaten, like from out of that cage, right?
Okay.
But then they decided what they were going to do because they got footage in Australia of an empty cage that was down in the water and a shark just going fucking ham on it and like killing the fucking thing. They're like, oh man, we got to put that in the movie.
Yeah.
Because that's so, so good. It looked great. But they're like, but if we do that, then he's attacking an empty cage. So at that point, we have to like let Richard Dreyfuss
get out of the cage.
We have to let him get out of the cage. So Hooper was originally supposed to die. Like Brody was supposed to be the only one that lived.
I think it's good though that he lived.
I think it was too. I think that'd been a bummer. It was a bummer that Quint died. But like I said, he had a Captain Ahab moment.
He had to die.
He smashed the radio. He blew the engine, even though, you know, the other guys were saying, hey, you know, the engine can't take it and all this other kind of shit because the shark had been like fucking the boat up.
Yeah, they got salt water and the fuel that burned up the fucking injectors too.
So he just got so, you know, he was just so overwhelmed by his mission to get this fucking shark and like get revenge on this fucking shark that he just made a bunch of stupid decisions.
Yeah, well, he put other people's life at risk.
Yeah.
And he had to go down like a Captain Ahab. And him with the Indianapolis story made sense because now it was personal to him.
Yeah.
His vengeance against these sharks was personal. So it made sense.
Yeah.
It made sense that he was pissed and wasn't going to give up and wasn't going to let anybody stand in his way. And it also made sense that he had to die by this shark.
Yeah. Because he could have got them all killed.
Yeah. Now, as it was gobbling him up, I think they maybe should have included something where he was at least able to stab it or hit it.
He did hit it with the machete.
Did he? Okay.
Yeah.
He should have hit it.
I thought he wounded it.
Right. Okay. Well, then okay. I didn't remember
because
seeing that.
Because didn't decide, like, when he comes, like, before Brody, like, shoots it, like, smile, you son of a bitch or whatever, and then they show it, like, under the water, isn't it, like, it has, like, a cut, like, on the side of its mouth or something like that?
I imagine he should have done it. Maybe I did see him do that. But
yeah, I thought he had the machete or because he grabbed the machete off the wall.
He
and I'm
gone
pretty
down
sure
fighting.
Yeah. Well, and he did. And I mean he was like screaming his head off. Yeah. And he got like bit in half, just like the, just like him. Just like the guy that
bobbed up on
the USS Indianapolis in the story that he told. So it's like everything about this is, I mean, this is one of the best made movies. And I like it because the storytelling is so economical. I kind of feel like a lot of movies, and just from any era, really, that, you know, movies that are not all that great. I think a mistake that a lot of people made is they over-explain things. They forget that it's a visual medium, that they can just show things instead of, like, telling things through dialogue or exposition or whatever, which is very clunky. Yeah. This one really just has... It's very, very economical in the way that it sets up the characters. You know, they say a couple of things that can, you know, hint about their past and stuff, but mostly it's kind of just like in their body language, the way they, you know, what stuff that's in the background, just, you know, stuff like that. And I just feel like that's the best way to go, because you really get a sense of them without having someone having to tell you.
The whole shark combat phase of the movie. The whole shark combat phase of the movie is kind of like something out of Fury Road. They're not telling, they're showing.
Yeah.
Running around from one side of the boat to the next and then tell each other, help, you know, you get this, cut that line. You know what I mean? I'm going to put another barrel in him. It's like a Fury Road.
Yeah, it's very action-oriented. Yeah. There's not a lot of, I mean, there's dialogue in it, but it's not.
They're just talking about the shark.
They're just talking about the shark, like what just like it would really be, like if you were there. You don't have time to, like, dick around and
We're looking to talk about
about your feelings or anything like that. It's like we're getting attacked by a fucking 25-foot shark that's going to eat
us. You got to talk about their feelings. You haven't been watching the damn movie.
Can we say, too, that we would be very remiss in talking about fucking Jaws, for Christ's sake, without talking about that fucking score.
Yeah.
John Williams.
Pretty good.
And honestly, he went on to work with Steven Spielberg for almost all of his movies subsequently, I think. But even Steven Spielberg himself said that this movie wouldn't have worked without that score. And he's like, seriously, 50% of the success of this movie is because of that fucking music.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really well done because... And I think this helps out a lot, too, with, like, you know, kind of building up the suspense and everything. And like I said, I think they were going to show the shark more a little bit, but obviously they had a lot of trouble with the shark, but didn't work and all this other kind of stuff. So they kind of kept it to a minimum, which famously ended up working in the movie's favor, because now everything is just suggestion. Like, you know, the first scene where Chrissy gets pulled under the water, you don't see anything. You just see her get pulled down. You know it's a shark because obviously you've seen the poster. But the rest of the stuff is just all suggestion. Like, you see kind of when the kid gets eaten, you know, you just kind of see a fin and a tail and the kid kind of flopping over. And then you see, like, his bloody float, like, come, like, wash up on the beach. And it's just, they don't really show the shark until later on. And so it's almost kind of like that theme song, like, stands in for the shark. So, you know, the shark's there because you can hear it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
One of the things that was odd about the movie, though, that I noticed while I was watching it, is that a lot of it took place on a beach filled with people in fucking bathing suits and bikinis. They even had a scene where a chick gets drunk, strips all her clothes off, and then goes skinny dipping. You don't really see anything, but... And all this is going on, beaches and skinny dipping and swimming, nude swimming and shit. And there's real. What's weird about the movie is there's no real sex appeal to the movie. You notice that?
Well, it's not really that kind of a movie.
No. But you would think an other movie would at least shown, like, you know what I mean, like some nudity, although Spielberg doesn't really do that. Or they at least would have shown, like, some hot bikini chicks. That's what normal Hollywood would have done that. This didn't do that.
Well, I think, too, that he wanted it to kind of convey the sense of place. Because a lot of the people, I mean, that is a real beach town. It's not called Amity, but I can't remember what the name of it is. But that is a real beach town that they filmed that in. I think it's on Martha's Vineyard. And he just wanted, so all the extras were just people from around there.
Yeah.
So he just wanted, like, he wanted the flavor of the place. So he used everybody from there, like, and just put them in the movie. So obviously they're not all going to look like fucking supermodels, you know.
I just thought it was odd. It was out of character for a Hollywood movie. There's usually a little more sex appeal in there.
That's something. It didn't really occur to me, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I saw the missed opportunities. Yeah.
Well, maybe he just didn't want it to be like a schlocky, like, monster movie.
But that's what it normally would have been.
Well, I know that.
Yeah.
But I think that maybe is what elevates it, too. Yeah. It's that it's kind of like I said, it's an action adventure movie and also a horror movie and also a nature run amok kind of movie. Right. But everybody can watch it.
Because you remember, like, the ripoff, like Piranha, had a lot of sex appeal in it. So they're always trying to compensate when they do that. Instead of that, they had a weird thing that when I was a kid, I could remember it. Because I saw it. I saw this a couple years after it came out, which I may have been 7 or 8. Brody's kid was having all these emotional reactions to shit. Chasing people on the beach, going, "Daddy, Daddy," or so crying and shit to try to add. He was like the emoticon. He's like the emoji of the fucking movie. And that was odd. I mean, not odd, really.
No, it's not odd. I mean, that's a pretty common thing. And Steven Spielberg did that a lot, too. It's
using
like,
kids to fucking...
Well, because that's something that most people are going to respond to a child to in danger.
Yeah.
That's always going to be scarier than an adult in danger because it's a little kid. Yeah. And the fact that Steven Spielberg actually had the balls to have several little kids get fucking eaten in this movie is like pretty fucking hardcore. Even though they didn't really... I mean, they didn't show it. They kind of showed it. And honestly, it's the suggestion of it is almost worse because it like leaves it to your imagination.
Well, that little kid never was in any danger himself. He was reacting to other people who were in danger.
Well, Brody had two kids. He had that little bitty kid and then he had like the slightly older
I'm talking about the little bitty kid.
Yeah.
He was always on the beach and if a crowd of people would be running, he'd say, "Dad," he'd yell some shit or somebody getting eaten and he'd go, you know.
I mean, the other kid that was slightly older, the one...
He was in danger.
He was in danger because he was, like, in the... Michael, I think that kid's name was. And and he was actually in the pond, you know, on the 4th of July, like, when the beach was crowded, when that shark attacked in the pond. So that kid, Michael, saw another guy get eaten, like, right by him. So
I thought it was an unusual ploy. It was one of the first times I've really kind of noticed them doing that. It did work, though. It worked.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, the fact that... His kid, I mean, him having those two little kids and then being around the water all the time. I think that was one of the things that, you know, and then Michael seeing that guy get eaten, like only a few feet away from him and him going into shock and having to go to the hospital and everything. I think that was the main thing that spurred Brody into getting over his fear and going, "I'm going to go out there and get that fucking thing because it could have eaten my kid."
Yeah, well, I guess Spielberg used that also in Close Encounters.
Yeah.
The little kid sucking, talking over
each Barry.
Other. Yeah, Barry. and then fucking the little kid's like, "Hey, can we throw dirt in our window too?"
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. You know, it was kind of, they were used more for comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, I've seen Jaws like a million times, but I probably haven't seen it for several years at this point. So we watched it again last night, the 45th anniversary. The transfer looks gorgeous. It sounds gorgeous. Fantastic. And I had forgotten, I remembered that there was funny shit in this movie, but I had forgotten some of the funny shit in this movie. One of my favorite scenes, and it's just such a throwaway, is when they're first on the boat. And Quint has his little can of Yingling or whatever, and he chugs it back, and then he crushes the can, and then he's like looking at Hooper, and then Hooper like looks back at him all serious, and he's got like some coffee and a styrofoam cup, and he drinks it, and just like crushes it while
like
he looks. I fucking love that. It's just like, it's just like little shit like that. I think most of the funniest shit in it is like Richard Dreyfuss, honestly.
Yeah,
he's just such a naturally funny guy. It's like not even jokes or anything like that. He's just a funny dude.
He's real likable. He plays real likable characters.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. And like I said, I think the trio of them, you know, being together and being so different, but then kind of teaming up like for this common goal, I think is one of the things that makes this a classic. And I mean, all the characters are likable. Quint is like, he's still likable, even though at first he kind of comes across like a dick because he's this salty old, nobody knows.
He was a dick.
Knows what they're doing except for me and blah, 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 and singing about bow-legged women and all that.
That was funny.
I know.
He is the swimming with bow-legged women. And I went, "Wait a minute, hold on. What is that? Okay." I had to analyze that a little bit when he said that.
So he's like, "Wait, what? Oh, okay, gotcha.
All right. Yeah.
Well, that first scene when they go to hire Quint in his fucking, shack or whatever, or his cabin. It's not a shack. And it's like, has shark teeth everywhere. And he has this, he gives Brody and Hooper some of his, I can assume it's moonshine. And he's like, here, I made that or whatever. Yeah, and then Brody drinks it. And he's like,
it's illegal, of course.
And then he passes by Hooper and he's like, don't drink this. It's just like little shit like that.
He wasn't acting like he was better than them. He was just letting them know that they were pussies compared to him.
Well, yeah, because he
was a tough motherfucker. He says, let me see your hands. And he goes, it's a soft hands, city hands. He's like, you can't come with me. Well, all that shit made sense from his point of view. Remember all the seamen that he tricked and tried to drive them on the damn rocks?
Yeah.
And they were out there trying to... So the local competition he was up against when it came to sea captains, they sucked compared to him.
There was a bunch of other morons who were throwing dynamite in the water, like all
trying to get the shit. So he was just laughing at them.
Yeah.
So he was better than every sea. He was the best sea captain on the island.
Yeah.
Who had a real history of service and sacrifice on the sea. You know, he was hardcore. All right. Nobody on the island could compare to him. How's one of these little city boys came from a university with soft hands, you know, and all this money? How is he going to compare to his toughness?
Yeah.
You know? And so he was right. You know what I mean? He was trying to establish dominance. You can't come with me. You won't survive the mission. But then finally he was okay.
But
you're chartering it so you can come.
Well, that's why I liked that one scene toward the end where, Quint is kind of like, he's actually never, the shark is like much, much larger than anyone that he's had to deal with before. And it's actually, they imply that it's a little bit smarter too, because it does a lot of crazy shit.
Yeah.
So he finally, after he kind of flips out, he destroys the radio, he kind of fucks up the boat. And then finally he gets to a point where he can say to Hooper, hey, like, what's this equipment do? Let's use this.
Yeah.
So he is a big enough man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a big enough man to admit, hey, my methods aren't working, so let's try your shit out. So they've established
high tech.
Yeah, so they've established like mutual respect between one another, which, like I said, I think that was a really, really great.
Yeah.
So all the character arcs are like really great in this, and how they, you know, they kind of forge this unlikely friendship.
Yeah.
To kill this fucking monster.
Yeah, and what he had was is he had this hypodermic syringe on the end of a damn pole with this drug that it was evidently enough to kill the shark. And he's like, can you get that needle through his skin? Like, I don't know. Like, maybe in his mouth. So, you know. Yeah, he was going to go with the high-tech route. They're going to put him into a cage. Let the shark bite the cage, and he was going to stab a shark in the mouth with that drug.
Which, that's pretty ballsy, because you wouldn't get my ass to do that.
Well, I think that's what they were trying to tell you.
Yeah.
Is that that little dude had the balls to get in that flimsy aluminum cage and basically sacrifice himself. He wouldn't have made it.
No.
You know?
And I think he kind of knew that.
I think he knew that, to sacrifice himself to save the rest of the crew. So, you know, Quint respected him. He's like, okay.
Yeah, he totally like got that he was, you know, just as good. They were coming at it from a different thing, but they had a common goal, and they were just coming at it from different ways. That's all. And so I liked that they established that kind of.
Yeah, it all worked out.
And they did it really subtly, like I said, just Quint like holding that gun up and saying, yeah, what does this do? Or what can you do with this or whatever?
Right,
like accepting, let's try it your way now and not making a big deal about it.
And Quint saw the weakness in it. The strength and the weakness. Yeah, the drug might do it, but what about that needle?
Yeah.
Can you get that needle through his skin? And the boy was like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have to get him in the mouth.
Yeah. Which, like I said, they had a plan.
Yeah.
So I don't know. This is a great fucking movie.
Yeah.
If you've never seen Jaws, what planet are you even from? Because I feel like it's so... This is one of those movies that's just so ingrained in... American culture, particularly, probably like worldwide, because it's like made $1 zillion like around the world, and it was a huge hit everywhere. But I kind of feel like this is so ingrained that even if you haven't seen it, you've kind of seen it.
I grew up as a kid, even swimming out in fucking the bayou, Louisiana, okay, with the vague fear of something coming up and biting me, you know, like big ass shark, which is not crazy because a shark can get into the fucking bayou.
Yeah.
They can go into fresh water.
Yep.
They can't stay in there for long, but long enough.
Long enough to eat you.
Yeah.
That's what I figure.
Tiger sharks do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, shit, man, this movie, I was scared of sharks anyway, because like I said, I grew up in Daytona Beach, right on the Atlantic Ocean. We went to the beach all the time, and I did see sharks, not as big as that one, obviously, but I did see them like quite often. And they would just scare the crap out of me, so I wouldn't really go in any deeper than thigh high or whatever. Yeah. So seeing this is like my worst fucking nightmare. Like being in the water and knowing that that shit is swimming around right underneath you, looking at your legs like, look at those little wiggly snacks up there. I'm going to fucking grab that shit. Yikes.
I went snorkeling at Sharm El Sheikh. That's down in the Gulf of Aqaba in Egypt, off coast of Sinai. Snorkeling next to those coral reefs that have fish following me. Some of them pretty big. Big old sheep's head. And I was always, you could look at that damn reef wall and be, and I was afraid of passing something like a damn tunnel that had a damn moray eel in it.
Yeah. Because those are no joke either.
Yeah. And then I'd look out into the ocean, had clear water, visibility was really good. And I always had this kind of vague fear that off in the distance, you'd see a big ass shark coming out of that blue. You know, and there'd be, you'd have to head for the surface and try to get up on top of the damn coral reef and you'd just get cut up. It's real sharp.
I mean, I think the, I think another reason too that this movie worked so well and why everybody likes this movie is because that's a very, very primal fear.
Yeah.
A lot of people have that fear of just this being in the water or being somewhere you can't really see.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden this massive like behemoth coming out of the darkness that can eat you.
In the situation I was in, you could see probably about 300 feet, which is enough visibility to see in enough directions to where you'd have time to worry.
Yeah. You know, that is like, that it was coming. No.
Yeah. I kept looking over my shoulder, you know, and there'd be fish back there following me.
Yeah.
Just wouldn't be a shark. What used to follow me was damn Sergeant Major fish and sheep's head. It looked like the damn head of a sheep following me. And I don't know what they were, they're just watching me to see what I'm doing.
Yeah, some fish are like that. It's like when I used to go snorkeling over at some springs over there in Central Florida, and you'd get like certain kinds of fish are just like real curious about like, people.
Yeah,
like, they're like, what are you? And they're just kind of like swimming around, kind of looking at your face and stuff like that.
Yeah, do you get food?
I guess like in a place like that where there's a lot of divers.
Yeah.
I mean, because you'd think in the wild, they wouldn't be following shit around.
No, they
like,
follow you.
Because it's like they think that maybe it was a predator, but I guess they know it's not a predator.
And a little Sergeant Major fish, they're probably about 6 inches in diameter, 4 to 6 inches in diameter, like a little discus type fish.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll bite you.
Yeah.
Not, they don't really break any skin.
Okay.
But they try to check. You'll feel one go boom and hitting you, and you turn around and a Sergeant Major taking off. You're like, what the fuck? To see if you take if he could get a bite. You know, fucking funny. They don't have any teeth.
Like, do you taste good?
Yeah, their teeth are like sandpaper. You know, they can't really break your skin, but they just check and see how soft you are.
Yeah.
Like, nope, no food.
Can I just, nope, okay. No snacks for me.
Funny to get bitten by a fish. A little bitty fish.
Yeah. Yeah, it's happened to me too. Yeah. But it's just funny the way they
they think they can get a
bite. They think they can get a bite through this big, huge, giant person.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so what was I going to say? Oh, I was going to say too that I had forgotten too. Not only had I forgotten how funny this was, I also forgot this has like some kind of gory shit in it. Like, you know, they don't show a lot like the, you know, Chrissy at the beginning, the one that gets the girl that gets eaten. They just kind of suggest like you can kind of see her hand and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they have that one scene where that dude's leg gets bitten off and the leg, which looks actually really real, floats down to the bottom. And then, like I mentioned earlier, that one of the best jump scares ever, like with that dude's fucking head popping out of the hull of the boat with the big fucking hole in it.
Yeah, I looked at it again. It's not its head. It's the whole torso.
It's the whole torso, but yeah.
It's connected to the body.
I think, you know,
I always thought it was just a head.
I did too. Isn't that weird?
But in HD, you see that, no, it's a whole body. Just that the head goes into the light.
Yeah, it just pops out the hole.
Yeah.
And I think that's done really well because I saw this other, like, I was watching a video that were kind of, like, analyzing how, you know, the suspense was built up in the movie and stuff. And they said the reason why that was such a good jump scare is that because up until this point in the movie, they had established that when the shark was around, you heard the shark theme.
Yeah.
But this time you didn't hear the shark theme because the shark wasn't around. So they're kind of like putting the audience at, you know, kind of relaxing them because like, oh, you're not hearing the music. So the shark's not there. And then pow, this fucking body comes popping out the hole. And it happened at any time. But yeah, seriously. Jaws 2, the sequel, was pretty good. But skip all the other ones. The third one, the 3D one, is awful, but it's actually pretty fun to watch, you know, just for shits and giggles if you're drunk or whatever. The fourth one had Michael Caine in it, and actually had the shark stalking that particular family. Like they moved to Florida or something, and the same shark, or it wasn't the same shark, obviously, because the
Michael
shark
had, Caine is in it. I gotta, maybe I gotta see that.
I saw it in the theater. That's how much of a sucker.
What year was that?
87, I think the fourth one came out. What was it called? Jaws the Revenge. Jaws the Revenge. And I think Lorraine Gary is in it too, who played Brody's wife in the first one. But he, you know, he had died subsequently, like Brody's character. And so she was a widow. And so she hooks up with Michael Caine, I think. I haven't seen it in a long time. But it's, you would probably love it. It's super, super cheesy. The whole premise of the movie is that she and her family have moved to Florida because this shark is apparently stalking them, because the shark is like super intelligent, and the shark stalks them like all the way to Florida and like targets them specifically.
They should have mixed that in with the island. Michael Caine pirates too. The pirates and the sharks.
Pirates
that was a
and
great
sharks.
Movie. You guys have seen Michael Caine in the island. That's a
yeah, we reviewed that one a while back. Yeah. So yeah, definitely.
That's a Florida movie. That there are pirates out there. The old pirates, they're still out there.
Yeah.
Hide now.
David Warner is a pirate.
Yeah.
But yeah, so now you got to see Jaws 4 because you probably, I think you probably like it.
I don't
know. It's not good, but it's, you know.
Probably amusing.
It is, actually. Yeah. It's bad, but it's fun bad. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. All right. So yeah, if you haven't seen Jaws, you need to get on that like right away because it's seriously...
Or seen it again, too.
How could you not have seen Jaws? I thought everybody in the world had seen it.
Seen it again in fucking HD. Blu-ray is fucking great.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it in a while, definitely you should check it out again, because I like to watch it every few years, you know what I mean? Just to
aged real well. It's classic, man.
It really did. It still looks fucking great. It still looks fucking great.
Yep.
But yeah, so that'll do it for this matinee. We will see you guys later. Bye.